Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, suffering sentient beings unaware of the real condition. What's up? Wake up. That's what I'm trying to do. How you go about it? Well, that's a different story. Depends on who you listen to. Depends on how much time you want to put in, how much money you want to spend, who you want to follow, what you want to believe. If you want to change your name, maybe you want to change to a Buddhist name, or you want to be called like a Hindu Alibaba or Ramda Baba something or another or what have you. You like being called an alcoholic. My primary identification was addict for so long that I didn't realize that I could expand beyond that, although I will say my condition as an addict has not disappeared. It's not my primary identification. It's not my primary orientation. I've achieved some degree of meditative stabilization. I wouldn't say that's a definitive enlightenment proclamation, but I will say that things are a heck of a lot better than ever. As the result, doing some practice, taking some steps, doing some psychotherapy. I wrote all about this in the 12-Step Buddhist. You can find it at the12stepbuddhist.com, but you probably already know that. Got back from a workshop I did in a couple of workshops in Florida. Drove across Florida. Hung out with the intherooms.com guys and met a nice lady who does yoga and stuff like that. A couple of nice yoga ladies. And thanks to everybody who came out, there were over 200 people at the Florida workshops. And I'm on my way to San Jose and San Francisco to do a few more talks, talking at the Dharma and Recovery Group on Tuesday. I think it's the 14th of July. If you're listening to this after that, then you can ignore it. But if you're listening to it before, come on out. I'll be at Sesshin Ling Tibetan Buddhist Center on Sunday evening, the 13th, 12th? Let's see, 9, 10, 11. It's the 11th. On the 9th, I'll be at Saturday Night Live group, Friday Night Speaker Meeting, sharing my story there. That ought to be fun. That's where I originally came into recovery. And when I showed up there after relapsing with 10 years, it was kind of a humiliating place to be. A lot of people had stayed. And they just looked at me like, do I know you? And I'm like, crawling under the chair. Anyways, 12 and a half years later now. Still clean, still sober, fully clothed, and in my right mind, as they used to say back then, or at least partially clothed and not as crazy. At any rate, off to San Antonio to discuss some aspects of self-dialoguing with the social worker population there, Department of Social Work, University of Texas at Austin. I think that's the 22nd, 23rd of July. You can double-check my website for that, or Amazon.com author profile, or booktour.com, or send me an email. I'm not so good with all the dates and calendar stuff. I know I'm off on, I think it's the 15th of August, to Detroit. We're going to do another workshop there for continuing education credits with some professionals and recovering people, so on and so forth. Very exciting. Working on a new book. I'll tell you about that another time. Doing a lot of progressive and interesting things here in Portland. And hope you've enjoyed the most recent podcasts and so forth. This next one is an hour long. I normally only go like 20 minutes, but the thing is, Larry Christensen, PhD, who actually wrote a blurb in the back of my book, had been my Zen teacher for a long time. He conducted the group, the 12-Step Buddhist group, on Monday night. And there's a lot of these groups around the country now. It's cool that people are starting them and looking for alternative ways to, not alternative ways, but ways to enhance recovery without necessarily seeking an outright alternative, but supplementing. And anyways, we've got this group on Monday night. It's been going for about a year and a half in that form. And I like to have guest speakers. So Larry came and did the deal. And it's about an hour long of his talk on the three A's, which are awareness, attention, and acceptance. I might have those wrong. You better listen to Larry. Remember what those are. But people loved it. I'm sure you'll love it too. You can give me a holler. Don't forget to keep buying the book and keep buying it for people and sending it off to people who need it and recommending it to Buddhists, Buddhist teachers, treatment providers, counselors, judges. We've got a drug court program going here in Portland where they're accepted my workshop as a alternative. They consider it as a meeting, so I don't like to keep using that word alternative. But it's not a typical, let's just say a non-standard approach. And a lot of different fun things going on, but keep it going. I don't think I get paid for another several thousand copies, so it would be nice to keep going with that and work on the next project and keep things going. So appreciate your help and support on that. But we do have a retreat coming up January 21st at Brighton Bush. It's going to be awesome. The last one was awesome, so you can look for that on the website soon to sign up in advance. And if you're coming to the Portland area, let me know, and I'll be happy to plug you into meetings and meditations and so on and so forth. So anyways, I'll stop blathering and plug you in with Larry. Hope you enjoy it. Talk to you soon. Oh, I turned on the recording on my iPhone like about a minute into his talk, so forgive that. And then at the very last part, he started talking about how to set up the cushions, so I just rolled that back so you don't have to listen to it. At any rate, talk to you soon, people. Keep Buddhaing.
Have an experiential understanding of that. Just paying attention to your breath, for instance, that you can't hold on to your breath, can you? You do, you die. And we need a constant flow of breath and water and food and interactions to be really alive. And yet our clinging to try to be separate and solid leads to more suffering. So as most of you all know, life can be a little challenging at times, can't it? That's the first noble truth in Buddhism, is that life is hard, life is suffering, life is painful. And why is that the case? Why is life so friggin' hard? Anybody? Yeah?
Because we have feelings?
We have feelings. Feelings are hard, aren't they? Like, I mean, we all want the good feelings, right? We want the joy and the happiness and the love and contentment. But what are some of the more, or even those might be kind of challenging for some of us. What?
We're selfish.
Selfish? Why is that hard?
Well, we want what we want, and we're more concerned with our wants than other people.
Yeah, why is that difficult, though, sometimes? I mean, usually we think, oh, yeah, I want what I want, and as long as I get it, it's fine, but what's the problem?
Nothing satisfying.
You don't get what you want, do you? Or even if you do, it doesn't last, does it? So it's a kind of a ongoing trying to get what you want, and that's a big, I think, part of addiction is that, nothing lasts, and so that drink or so that cookie or that drug or that love or that whatever we try to go after, it doesn't really hold. It kind of slips through our fingers and then we're off to the next thing and we're not really satisfied with things as they are. Why else is life so hard and painful? Anybody?
Our perception?
Our perception? Yeah, like what, for instance? We have all kinds of judgments, don't we? And we, unfortunately, a lot of those judgments are directed where? To ourselves, or them, like, you're not okay, and you're not okay, and this isn't okay, and what happens when we have those judgments? We kind of tighten up, don't we? We don't like that person, so we try and figure out how to deal with that. We're tense. We come up with all kinds of strategies, and usually those don't work. And if we have judgments about ourselves, that doesn't feel so good. Our bodies don't cooperate half the time.
we're in pain physically. We all eventually get sick and get old and die. It's not a particularly pleasant trip. I mean, there are nice times that come along too, isn't it? But, you know, we lose it all eventually. So what are the main ways that we try to deal with our pain?
Consumption.
Yeah, and what is that attempt to try to do?
Distract?
Yeah, we might sort of take our attention somewhere else. We might try and change the way we feel.
Okay.
We cover it up. If we rationalize or take in, we try to cover that up and make it different, don't we? What's the trouble with that, though? Yeah, comes back, and usually if we take in too much of that stuff, we get a little constipated or don't feel good afterwards, or we want more of it. We're trying to get control over how we feel, and that's really very natural to us, isn't it? I mean, we want to try and control how we feel. The trouble is, what? We aren't, are we? That's a tough one. We don't really aren't in control of how we feel, and oftentimes not even in control of what we think. I mean, just doing a little bit of meditation, just watch your mind. Wow, where did that thought come from? Where did that urge come from? Where did that... If we think that we are our mind, though, we're in sort of a little bit of trouble. Because what is our mind? Anybody ever heard that song by Jimmy Dale Gilmore? It's my mind has a mind of its own. You know, so it takes me out walking when I'd rather be at home. You know, if we believe our mind, it sort of leads us around in all sorts of uncomfortable, unpleasant positions and places. But our mind has an agenda. And it evolved in the savanna about a couple million years ago, and its main agenda is what?
Survival.
Yeah, we're the most interested in survival. Evolution said, you better be on guard. You ever seen baboons or monkeys? Their main agenda is they're on guard. They're out there looking for the thing to get or the thing to avoid. You know, the lion, of course, is the main thing. So we're not that far away from the baboon and the monkeys, that we're on guard, we're watchful and fearful creatures. That part of our mind really hasn't evolved that much. Most of us, let's face it, all of us are anxious. We're afraid, and there's plenty to kind of be afraid of, isn't there? I mean, who knows who might think a bad thought about us? We have to be on guard for that. Who might disregard us, or what things we might lose from our partner to our job, to our body, to our mind, to, you know, those things that might get taken away. So we're anxious creatures. We can think of millions of things to be afraid of. And frankly speaking, there are millions of things to be afraid of. So life is painful. We're on guard for that pain to try to figure out how to get rid of that pain, how to manage that pain. And what happens when we can't get rid of it or we can't deal with it? What happens? We get sick. How do we get sick mentally?
Aggravated.
Yeah, we might get angry or, you know. Pardon?
Frustrated,
yeah, with things the way they are. I might get frustrated with myself. That isn't very pleasant, is it, to go around living life frustrated or angry? What's another way that we might deal with pain that we can't really get rid of?
Medicate.
We might medicate, take drugs, take medication. How about depression? Yeah, what do you think depression is? Everybody here has probably been a little depressed at times.
you might just give up before you feel like we're in pain all the time.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I think depression is kind of a way of giving up. We sort of close down so we don't feel things. So I think anxiety is one way that we try to avoid feeling things. We try and manage and control, you know, so that we don't get in pain. And depression is another way to sort of deal with things when we're in too much pain. We sort of close down so we don't feel. Now, what's the trouble with that? I mean, it kind of works to some extent, but we don't feel so good, do we? We feel kind of crappy, and we tend to not want to enjoy life or do things. We don't have the motivation or the energy to even get out of bed sometimes. What's the other thing that costs us when we're trying not to feel?
Nothing is a really useful thing until something's happened in your family or whatever, and you realize you missed it because you were numbing, you were so busy numbing that you were awake to things that you might have been able to change. So I think that has proven to me the downside, which I can say 4 or 5 years ago, I thought there wasn't a downside to numbing at all.
Yeah.
So it's just taking time to realize that, you know, the sacrifice, of course, is really missing some vital pieces of information that happen that we can change. So numbing against what we can't change shuts us off from the things that we can change. So, and then those things change on their own, and we're more unhappy than ever about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it gives us the power of choice.
Yeah, I think whether it's drinking or drugs or eating or sex or gambling or obsessing or whatever your particular thing is, depression sometimes. And not that any of these are really in your control, but these are ways of really not feeling. Ways of trying to control the way you feel, and numbing is a good word for that. You know, sometimes these feel like they're kind of enlivening you, but they really take away really what's important in your life, which is your heart, which is located down here. You know, when you are too numb, or you're too stoned, or you're too caught up in eating or obsessing with something, you're not really in touch with those things that are meaningful in your life. So those, you know, our brains are kind of wired for that. It's not our fault that we want to numb or that we do numb. But it does take us away from really those important things that allow us to live a kind of a life of satisfaction. And that's where I think the spiritual part comes in. Because unless we start to connect with our heart, unless we start to connect with things that are meaningful and satisfying, we don't really know what some of those things are. We're kind of like raised, unfortunately, in this culture where it's acquiring things and having experiences is more important than trying to learn what's living a meaningful or valued life. So most of you have tried to find what that is. What is really going to satisfy you in your life? What are some of those things that you found that are a little more satisfying in your life than the next cigarette or the next glass of booze or next sex or anybody?
For me, it's connections with other people. I can have relationships. I can be present for people. That's really the most fulfilling.
Yeah. What is satisfying about that?
Helping other people.
Uh huh.
Human solidarity.
Yeah, feeling like you're a part of things, mm-hmm. like you. Can be empathic. You can understand somebody. Someone can understand you. Someone you can care about someone. Isn't that such a gift? I mean, to be able to care and to be empathic and to love. I mean, what a miracle! Who would have guessed that out of a bunch of swamp gas, things evolved where you can love and care and connect with people. Be kind. Who was raised So that kindness was a value in their family. I mean, some of us, you know, but I didn't know that kindness was a something that you could cultivate and be in my family. I had to learn that. You know, teach that in school. Maybe these days they're starting to.
In Portland schools, maybe.
Yeah, I heard some mindfulness is going to be started to be taught. Wow, that is awesome, isn't it? So kindness and connection and caring and love, those sort of things come from the heart and tend to be a little more satisfying in our life. And being numb, whether it's through drugs, alcohol, obsession, getting, clinging, numbing through depression, those sorts of things really block you from living a life that is of value and of satisfaction. Oftentimes that's really hard lesson one. And it's not an easy thing. I mean, just sitting here meditating, see how quickly your life gets drawn up into your mind, and your mind, you know, starts to think it's in the driver's seat. No, back seat. It's in the bus. It's part of the whole crew that's in the bus, but it doesn't get to drive. You know, it thinks it's the driver. So all of us, to some degree, you know, are stuck with this mind that is critical. You know, it's judgmental, it's critical, it has all kinds of thoughts and judgments. And I call it the critic, right? I think you, do you have that term? You use the critic? That's its job, is to be critical. And it's helpful to some degree, right? You want to know if you're going to go buy an apple or an orange. Yeah, I like an apple better. When you start to think of people as apples and oranges, no, I like this person more than that person, then you're going to go over here and you're going to avoid that person. You like this part about yourself and you don't like that part about yourself. You start to narrow your life. You start to be restrictive in your life. You start to avoid those things that you think are going to lead to pain. Then you start to restrict yourself. So I think practice, spiritual practice, comes down to kind of a choice in life. On one hand, you can choose to live a life of restriction, which tries to really restrict your pain, but it also then restricts and numbs your heart. That's a life that you can choose, and most of us have tried that, and it kind of works a little bit. We don't feel quite as much pain, but then we don't get to live a life that's satisfying and free. The other side is we get to live a life that's loving and compassionate and free, but what else goes with it?
Responsibility.
It's painful, and responsibility, you know? It's painful. So we get this choice. We can either live a life that's painful, but it's free and loving and responsible, or we can live this life that's not painful, but it's numbing and restrictive and unsatisfactory. So it does kind of get down to this choice. And, you know, most of the time, it's an unconscious choice that we make. You're sort of like automatically going over to this, I'm going to avoid this pain. You know, I don't want to do that. That was too painful, our mind says. Meditation and a spiritual life gets us the opportunity to notice that. When we sit still and watch our mind, it's not its fault, that's its job, is to try to avoid pain. Let's go over here. This will be a little easier. Right? And you get to say, no, sweetheart, we've tried that, right? That was too painful. That was not the way we want to live. Becomes a matter of compassionately, and this is where our heart comes in, bringing our whole self back over to this side and say, no, we want to live a life of compassion and freedom and openness. It's a little more painful, but this is the side that we are choosing to go down. No, I want to go over here. I know. So I know AA has initials, right? AA. I have three initials, except that Ted said two A's, it's three A's. AAA. The first A that I emphasize is awareness. Right? We have to start to pay attention to the way that our mind directs us over here to this path of numbness and restriction. That's what it thinks is helpful. We have to pay attention. We have to be aware of that. Then we can have some choice in the matter. We can start to not buy into that. That's really very simple, but it's not very easy to do. What do we do when we start to notice that? Start to notice that our mind, it's like a, you know, when we're sitting, it's like all these cars going by, all these thoughts, you know. Oh, here comes another thought, here comes another thought, here comes another thought. And then there's a thought, that slows down and has your name on the door. Larry, hey, remember me, buddy? Come on in. Let's go for a drive. You know, pretty soon you're down the road, find yourself out having a drink. Oh, yeah. Or wanting to have a drink. Oh, yeah, a little awareness. What do you do then when you have that awareness? What's the next step?
For me, it's almost like behaving out of faith. You know, rather than trying to think myself out of the situation, like if I'm sitting at home and isolating, I almost have to behave out of faith that getting off my butt, walking out the front door, will be better than just numbing out and watching TV.
Yeah. So you have to have some sense that there is a different way to go, don't you? You have to have some faith, some path, and I think that's the miracle of a group like this, is you get to hear these stories, you get to try this out by listening. There's some part of our brain called the mirror neurons. Anybody ever hear of those? It's like when we see something that makes sense, we can learn how to do that without having to try it out ourselves. We can see, wow, this person has done this. We can almost learn just by watching. Our brain has that capacity to do that. You know, try the other way out too, but we can also try out those more healthful and compassionate ways. So awareness, and then I don't know if any one of you ever heard of Rajneesh. He had some screwy ideas, but he had one thing that I liked. He said, don't just do something, sit there. You know, so instead of acting on that thought, you know, just sit there and watch things. Just see if you can be with what's going on. That's the second A, accept. Just see if you can accept things as they are without having to do anything about it. See if you can watch your crazy mind go on and spin and plan and come up with all kinds of ideas that what needs to be done. You know, it tortures you enough, doesn't it? See if you can torture it. Just sit there. All right, let's see if you... Because it can't really do much, can it? All it can do is give you a bunch of ideas and criticisms. What really allows you to do something is your heart. You know, that's where action, true action, comes from. I mean, you can follow your mind, but you don't have to. You have a choice there. You can just accept the way things are. Acceptance opens up possibilities. There's a great saying by a Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who said, you know, have the mind of a beginner. You know, in the mind of an expert, there's few possibilities. In the mind of a beginner, there's a lot of possibilities. If you know what you need to do, if you're listening to your mind, there's only one direction that you can take, right? It's what your mind is telling you. you don't know, wow, it's like everything's possible then. If you don't know, right? All kinds of possibilities. So we say, don't know mind. I don't know. I'm just going to see what happens. So this acceptance is the second A. Right? Just trying to accept the way things are, warts and all. It sounds good, doesn't it? Well, that's where your heart, that's where a little compassion can come in. You know, how do you really accept yourself the way you are? Because that critical mind has all kinds of judgments and stories and beliefs about the way you should be or the way you could be or the way you have to be. What have you found that's helpful in trying to just accept yourself the way you are? Anybody?
To focus on what I know for sure versus all the things I don't know.
Yeah, like what might be a thing you know for sure?
Like I'm sitting here, I'm pretty sure about that.
Yeah. You can always focus on your butt, you know? Your butt's sitting down, isn't it? It's doing a pretty good job. It knows exactly how to be a butt, doesn't it? Your nose knows how to be a good nose. You're able to hear, and you're able to understand. You're able to see. You're able to digest and move your limbs. Everything actually works pretty well, doesn't it? If you just let it alone and let it be. How else can you be accepting of yourself? Besides, you know, if you really pay attention to just what is, if you really take the first thing, attention, awareness, and really just focus on actually what's happening, acceptance kind of follows. If you can just pay attention, oh yeah, well, okay, it's so far so good. You know, okay, it's a little uncomfortable. I can be with that. So. That thought, oh yeah. Notice that. That's okay. What's next? But what else is helpful to really accept the way things are?
Gratitude.
Gratitude. Wow. Yeah, man.
It could always be so much worse.
It's really kind of cool that we're just here, isn't it? I mean, it's really a miracle. That you can see and hear and breathe and love and hate and feel bad and all that stuff just kind of comes and goes. It's just a miracle that we can even see and hear. I'm really grateful that there are people around that I can share this life with and that we can help each other out. I've come to learn what I have so far in life, gratitude. I think a spiritual sense that there's more that's helping out, whether you think of it in terms of a higher power or something just as simple as, wow, that the earth is kind of here for me, you know? It's holding down my butt and the air for me to breathe and it's allowed the plants to grow up that I can eat and nourish my body, and the sun grows these things and warms the air so that I can breathe. And actually, all of these things are really contributing to me. I mean, I kind of just grew up out of the earth in a certain way. It's all supporting me. I wouldn't be able to be here for a second if everything wasn't kind of contributing and participating in my life. So, from the farthest star away to the littlest tiny ant, everything is kind of working together to support my life. And appreciating that, that's the third A, just appreciating how miraculous and interconnected everything is. Even the difficult things, you know, like a simple thing like a little discomfort in your body or a little pain in your knee or something like that. Just trying to appreciate that, wow, how that kind of has come together to warn me that there's a little problem here that I should pay attention to. Just appreciating even some of the difficulties, let alone some of the beauties and some of the magic in life. Compassion is, I think, essential for spiritual life. We can't do this without some kindness and some compassion. And the Buddha said, you, above all others, deserve your love and your compassion. It starts here, you know? Simple practice of saying, oh, may I be happy and may I feel relaxed and at ease today. And may I feel love and peace. Just those, that simple thing that you can do for yourself and extend that to others. That, what a beauty. We didn't invent that, did we? Anybody invent compassion? No. It comes with the body, you know? And some of us have to work a little harder than others to cultivate it, but, you know, you can, it's like, you know, working out or doing anything. A little 5 minutes a day, and it starts to grow, and before you know it, you got a little compassion, a little kindness to yourself. Wow, this is hard. Doing the best I can. You know, just trying my best, I know that. I can give myself a little break. You know, take yourself off the hook. Just breathing, letting it go. Simple things like that, I think are really helpful in just accepting your life the way it is, starting to appreciate it. So, reaching out, a sangha, community, reaching out and feeling that Earth is here to support me, that there is a compassion in everybody's heart, that whether they know it or not, I think everybody loves you. You can start to notice that. You can start to notice that, oh yeah, your heart is available for compassion to others. Started, so awareness, first day, right? Starting to aware that it's not our fault that our mind is so crazy. It's we came with us from the savannah. It's designed to try and keep us out of trouble and get those things that we think are going to help. But it's not the boss, you know? So it goes in the back seat. It's helpful sometimes, but we don't have to listen to it. You know, so the meditation's really helpful for learning that we aren't our minds. We don't have to listen to it. It's not the boss. What's the boss?
The heart.
The heart. Yeah, it's not that far away. You know, it's just a couple feet. Bringing your attention down here, learning to drive the bus from your heart instead of your head. That heart can accept things the way they are. You know, just second in. Just allow things to be and appreciate the third day. Starting to appreciate that addiction, even though it's hard, we all suffer because of it. You know, you wouldn't be here today. You wouldn't be hearing this. You wouldn't be learning that there's more to life than just your little self. You wouldn't have come here unless you were addicted. So starting to appreciate, wow, this kind of was a hard little path, but it kind of opened some doors for me. I want to, like, maybe bow to your addiction. You know, it's a thing that you wouldn't have really discovered a spiritual path probably without that. So a little karma, even though it's been hard, you can maybe appreciate and give your thanks to it. Okay? How are we doing? Any questions or thoughts? I know it's a little rambling and maybe a little too much lecture than what from what you're used to, but any thoughts about what I have said so far? I'm sorry?
I did perfect. I take notes.
I'm curious to the challenges people have with this, with what you suggested. If people are having any, if you get it, then you get it. But if you don't get it, talk about that now, you know, and find out how to get it more deeply. In other words, don't wait till later to say, well, I didn't really understand what they were talking about, or how to do this, or how do I really apply it. This is a good time to discuss it.
I got a question about acceptance. Some things, for some reason, it's like tough for myself, like when I own something that I don't like or something, it's tough for me to accept it. And then but sometimes I don't know how I accept it, but eventually I do. And then I could be, or then I experienced the third day, I forgot what it was. I fell asleep. But my question
appreciation, yeah.
Yeah, appreciation, right. So I guess coming to the acceptance point.
Yeah, all of this is can be a little subtle. For one thing, there's the paradox of acceptance and change. I mean, there's obviously a lot of things that we would like to change, right? And so having that plan or that intention to change is oftentimes a helpful thing, but you have to little notice if there's, I have, that part of that change is I can only accept myself if I change. You know, I'm only okay if I get to the thing that I want to be different. What really is helpful for change is to accept yourself the way you are right now and then say, I'd like to change. You know, how I wish or my intention is to change, but to not beat up on yourself, not to say, oh, I'm not okay unless I get to that change. Because oftentimes you can't really change until you accept yourself the way you are. And let's face it, you couldn't be any other way than you are right now, could you? I mean, it's impossible. You are the way you are right now. I mean, maybe you want to be different, and that's part of the way you are right now too, isn't it? I wish I was different. Oh, well, that's the way you are right now. Yeah, you want to be different. Okay, I can see that. So, trying to accept right in this moment. Now, what is helpful is to actually come back to the actual physical experience of what is happening right in the moment. That's a place that you can anchor into and kind of accept. I mean, it may be uncomfortable, and part of your mind may say, I wish it was different, but, you know, gently come back to that physical sensations and say, well, for this breath, I'm going to just try and be with this uncomfortable sensation. Wow, I did that. Okay, let's try another one. I can't do it for another one. Oh, there's the mind. Okay, thank you. Let's see if we can, if that's true. Wow, three, I did it. Okay. That's the beauty of this moment. Is usually in this moment you can be, you can accept what is. It's your mind that says, I can't take it. It's too much. You know? Well, let's see. See if I can do it for one more moment, one more breath. We say one day at a time. How about one breath? Sometimes it's one breath at a time, isn't it? Sometimes it's, that's the kind of acceptance we're talking about. Sometimes it's just down to that. Yeah.
You know, a lot of things that I'm wondering about, as I'm experiencing right now, it's kicking my brain out into the back. Really experiencing that a lot. I think. Maybe, okay, you know, sitting there listening to it. But at what point, you know, did I, does that critical mind become valued to me? And how do I know? I don't know when to trust my judgment to listen to them or not, you know. And that's sometimes I find myself feeling like I'm just being stagnant in my life. And maybe right now that's where I'm supposed to be. And that thought crosses my mind that maybe I might slow down a little bit. But there's a trust, you know, like where do I trust that critical portion of myself? And I'm not there.
Yeah. I think that's where it's really important to sort of try and see what your values are in life. You know, what are those you were 30 years down the road going to look back and say, you know, what would I think I could be proud of in terms of the way I live my life? And, you know, maybe I did this X, Y, and Z, but, you know, try to not stick to things that you did or accomplishments, but the way that you lived out of compassion, let's say, or kindness. I don't think it's that hard to come up with those values that really resonate with us, most of us, out of love, or maybe you want to be engaged with life, or, you know, connected with life, or, you know, try to find out what are those values in your heart that kind of give you that compass that you can direct your life from, and I think that's helpful. Then whatever you decide, trying to come from whatever you decide to do, you know, trying to come from those places of that value, I think that's helpful. And always, you know, I think we're always doing our best, so try to be kind to yourself and, you know, I'm going to give it my best shot and try to be kind and learn from your mistakes. Because I think, you know, we are doing our best. It's another one of those axiomatic things. We couldn't do any better than we do. We would. We could.
I have a problem with working from the heart and feeling vulnerable. I feel like I'm just out there and putting my mind in the back seat just is so raw to me, just having, you know, all my emotions out there. Where do I bring the critical mind in with the vulnerability and just be aware, okay, I'm vulnerable and accept it, or I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, again, it's a little bit of a balancing act. I mean, you know, your critical mind can be helpful. I say, don't be too vulnerable with these people. And sometimes that's wise, you know, to protect your heart. So bring a little wisdom and a little, you know, as much as you can into it. But try to recognize when it's out of fear, you know, as opposed to just a sort of wise mind. You know, if it's too restrictive, you can usually tell with your body. And then you have a choice of whether, you know, you're willing to risk it and live with the possibility of pain. Because it's painful. But I think trying to live a life that has some vulnerability is really worth it. Because you get to connect, you get to feel strongly, you get to participate with your heart. And personally, I think it's worth a few bumps. You know, as long as you have a kind of a community that you feel like is there for you and you can, you know, trust and come back to. I think that's, I think it's worth the risk. Yeah.
You spoke to the need for compassion for others, not the need, the ideal behind compassion for others. And I think it's important to remember also kind of bookended on that to allow the compassion from others for yourself. And so often we get to a point where we're not accepting that other people do love us and do care about us and do want us to be happy and okay. And I've found that that's where having a little bit of my vulnerability gets rewarded, because if I leave it out there, at the end of the day, I can remind myself that it doesn't matter what mistakes I made, what problems I caused or created or fixed, that I've got people that love me, care about me, want me happy and help me good, and then it doesn't matter if somebody else along the way caused me a little pain, gave me one of those bumps.
Yeah.
Because I can still go home to the people that love me.
Yeah, that's so important. It's oftentimes easier for us to be kind and compassionate than to take it in. Because it does involve a little vulnerability, you know? And so, you know, just try and notice when you say, oh, it was not that, or, oh, yeah. And just try to be there with somebody's kindness and appreciation. It's a kind of a little test, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Thanks.
I have a question just about how much of what you were talking about tonight is Zen,
how much is psychotherapy, and then what's the difference between what you do in the Zen Center and dealing with the, you know, the basic, your definition of the basic problem and the solutions, between what you would do as a Zen teacher and what you would do if someone's seeing you in your office for psychotherapy?
Well, I think the heart of a Buddhist teaching and Zen and problems in life is what I mentioned, that we all think we have a separate, fixed, lasting self. And, you know, unfortunately, we think that self isn't so great. It would be fine if we had this solid, fixed self that we thought was fine, was good, but for the most part, we think that our self is not okay. And so, I don't know what, who decided that was a good idea, but most of us have this belief that we're lacking, that we're inadequate and not okay or unlovable. And that's what brings almost everybody into psychotherapy, and that's what causes most of the difficulties in life, including, you know, wars and murders and stuff like that. So I think it's pervasive. I think it's a spiritual question that oftentimes people don't really get to in their spiritual life, and they may start to get to it a little bit in psychotherapy, but most people in psychotherapy come in when the shit has hit the fan and they just want to feel good, which is understandable. We all want to feel good. And then once they start to feel good, they will usually leave psychotherapy. And they might be back, but a few people, and I try to plant the seed that, you know, life isn't just about starting to feel better. Life is about starting to really appreciate the connection and the love and the boundlessness of life. And, you know, that can move from psychotherapy to a spiritual practice, or there can be a kind of a mix while we do that very seamlessly, I think, if somebody gets to that point, which I think, you know, most of you probably have a little taste of that. We work on our personal problems, but there's a bigger issue that we're all involved in. That's life. I mean, we're not separate from the whole of life. Wherever we go, the whole of life goes with us. And we do, like someone mentioned, we do have a responsibility to the whole of life. It's not just our little corner that we're worried about, that we affect everything as we go through life. So if we're happy, the whole world is happy.
So you're saying, I think that the psychotherapy is more like a stopgap, sort of a crisis intervention, whereas Zen practice is more enduring and more requires more of a commitment.
People can realize themselves in therapy. They don't have to go to Zen practice, but Zen practice is easier. Because there's a structure, there's a way of doing it, there's a community. Trying to do it on your own is really hard without some community, some formal practice. Some people can do it, but not very many. And psychotherapy is usually, people are interested in feeling better, and hopefully they can start to see that there's more to life than just that.
But psychotherapy doesn't give you a structure to hang the rest of your life on.
Usually not. There's some things, like there's something called ACT. Anybody ever heard of that? Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. It's based on mindfulness and values and the self as context, not self as separate. So some of these, I think, are moving more toward, you know, certainly spirituality and psychotherapy is getting more and more mixed together. There's a lot of mindfulness now in psychotherapy. So I think we're moving toward the direction that it's not so separate. Hopefully we'll get there.
You're also a Jungian analyst. Is that correct?
Not Jungian, just it's called relational.
I'm wondering if you can shed some light on some of this work that we do with the aspects of self.
Yeah, we all have these different parts of ourselves, you know, we might call them the critic or the comforter. Most of us don't know the comforter so well. More vulnerable kid part, the protector, those different parts of ourselves that we sort of have on, all of us are on the bus, you know, and we tend to act those out with one another, too. We can be critical or comforting with one another or protecting kid-like with one another. And we tend to find those people that we can relate to using those different aspects of ourselves. And if we're doing it unconsciously, we tend to reconnect with people based on old patterns that we established early in life. And so that's where problems in our relationships tend to appear. And it's not necessarily bad, because they can be, if we come at it in a conscious way, they can be opportunities for teaching and learning. If we do it with somebody that has that same kind of intention, wow, we can do it together in a relationship. So part of therapy might be trying to enact those same patterns with a therapist that is trying to do it more consciously and say, wow, the way we're interacting here with one another looks very similar to the way you're describing that you had with your dad or with your partners. And I'm wondering if we can bring some awareness to this and maybe some compassion and see if there's a different way of doing it. So this relational way of working psychotherapeutically can be a way to sort of try new ways of being and relating with the therapists that are more compassionate and open. So, you know, you can do this on your own, obviously. You can do this with a partner. You can do this with friends. You can do this in a community. But, you know, we all tend to get into our little corner of fear and anxiety too, and that's not bad. But you know, you can say, "Hey, sorry, I think I was just getting a little anxious and upset with you. Can we talk about that a little bit?" Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
Could you touch a little more on the last thing you said before you just went into this, which was that idea that people come to therapy because they want to feel better, and that they've realized and feeling better, and it's just an interesting concept, something I, you know, come to terms with over time, that, you know, feeling good about is kind of a subjective call, and, you know, who's to say we're supposed to feel a certain way all the time, you know, up or down or whatever. I think culturally we put a label or a judgment or a value on a certain way of feeling over another. So I just wonder what you meant when you said there's more to life than feeling, maybe feeling good or bad.
Yeah, I think it is a cultural phenomenon for our society, particularly that, you know, through medication or through advertising, through all sorts of things, we are led to believe that we can feel good all the time, or we should feel good all the time. And, you know, like Buddha said, no, that's just not possible. Life can be painful. And so trying to just feel good tends to get us into more of a controlling and restrictive way of life. So just trying to feel good, although that's usually what we want in life, that leads us to a narrow kind of way of being, and we don't get to live a life that's more fulfilling and satisfying, particularly coming from our values, let's say, of compassion and engagement and care and love. To live a life from those values, you're going to suffer. that's a painful life, but it's a satisfying life. That leads, that can be a more rich and fulfilling and giving and satisfying life. It's not maybe a happy life in the normal ways. I mean, it can be a joyful life, but it's not a feel-good kind of life that we normally think of as, this is, oh yeah, I just want to feel good. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically, the feel-good becomes the same chase as any other drug, alcohol, whatever. Just the avoidance of bad feelings or chasing a good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like...
restrictive, yeah.
Controlled, restrictive way of life. It's a very interesting phrase.
That kind of brings up a good point on what you're saying about vulnerability. I was wondering what you would say about, you know, having a life-threatening illness, you know, a situation you cannot change. And try, if you've worked with people who deepen their practice maybe as the result, because they find themselves, they're already a practitioner, yet they find themselves with cancer or something. And how does that work? What could you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, we all have a life-threatening disease, don't we? I mean, we're all in a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of time. Most of us, you know, in one sense, you guys are lucky. You know, you came up against something that just doesn't give. And you realize that I'm not going to get out of this. That we are in this for good, you know, that we need to really think about it and accept things as they are if we're going to get some kind of satisfaction out of it. And, you know, when you're up against something that you just can't escape and you have to surrender to life, that's quite a gift. That's not to say that then just don't go back. Okay, I surrendered that time. I'm going to go back try and get control again now that I've beaten cancer. But, you know, in a certain way, coming up against those things that in your life where you can't do anything about it, you just have to kind of surrender, those are kind of gifts. No one likes it, but you start to accept things as they are. And when you do that, you can actually relax a little bit. And kind of go with the flow and let the ego kind of sit in the back seat. And, you know, it doesn't sit back there for long usually, but wants to get up there. Okay, we did that. That's fine. It worked out fine. That okay, that was good for that, but I'm going to get back in control. So, you know, it's one of those processes of coming back and surrendering. I think that's even in sitting, in Zen, you know, we say don't move. You know, just be with that uncomfortable sensation and see what your mind doesn't want to do that. And just see if you can come back to surrender to the way things are. And nobody wants to do that.
During the 12-step Buddhist retreat last January, Darren led us through some Tongan meditation to improve compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you would submit another form of guided meditation that can develop compassion.
Well, you know, I think just the traditional metta practice is very good. I like that one, where you just, you know, simple put your hand on your heart, because they've done some interesting studies where, you know, do you mind if I hold your hand for a second? You know, if you hold somebody's hand, you can transmit compassion very easily with just a touch. Your hand is naturally compassionate. Whether when you hold your hand or you put it over your heart, you can feel that, you naturally are kind. So just putting your hand over your heart, I think, is a very compassionate thing to do. And just feel into your heart as best you can and just say, may I be happy. Just try to send yourself a little happiness. May I be content. and these. Breathe that into your heart. You feel love. You feel joy. Just to do that, you know, for 5 minutes a day. That's just for, just in that minute there, you probably could feel a little something. You can't do it for yourself, you know, you find that hard to do for yourself. Think of a puppy or, you know, something tender, a baby that you'd like to send kindness and compassion to, you know. But just a simple breath practice. That's, I think, the essence of Tom Rhythm is just breathing in, oh, I accept things. Breathing out, I let go. Breathing in, I just accept things the way they are. And that's just a simple, just allowing your physical sensations to be there. Breathing out, just allow things to be. Let go of my clinging. Open my hand. Breathing in, allow things to be. Breathing out, I let go of the attachments. So just a breath, I think that's the essence of kind of breath practice. You could say the same for hearing. Hearing just comes and goes. It's your mind, right? Oh, that shouldn't be there. Hearing doesn't have any problem with that noise. It just is. We're seeing.
So, do you think it's the same statement as the truism to say that, you know, it is the mind that's actually attaches with not wrong or whatever, and it's the heart that just really. It's the openness, it's the release, so when they exhale,
we'll
be released the mind, really. Mm-hmm. Because it just seems like from here
now,
there's
it's okay.
Yeah, it's from here up.
Yeah. You know,
sort of like,
Yeah. It's the mind, it's the words, it's the concepts, it's the, you know, that kind of clinging. Actual, you could say the heart, or you could actually say experience. There was this one Zen teacher, Chinese Zen teacher, whenever asked a question, he would just raise one finger. What does that mean? So just go to your finger, you know, feel your finger. Finger's okay, isn't it? No problem with your finger. So just, whenever you have a problem, just go to your finger.
Not give someone the finger.
Yes.
Go to your finger.
That's
private
finger.
Go to your hand, go to your body. You know, it may be uncomfortable, it may be painful actually, but there's not a problem there. There's not a... It's the story. What?
When you have a problem, you go to your finger?
Yeah, feel your finger. It's not a problem in your finger, is there?
Oh, I got what you're saying.
What?
I understand what you're saying now.
Yeah. Or your hand, or your body. Breath, hearing, seeing. Experience is okay. It's the story that goes with it, the judgment,
right.
Criticism.
I think Mark Twain once said, my life's 1,000 calamities, some of which actually happened.
Yeah. I appreciate all of your efforts, really. And it, you know, we're all in this together. We all need each other, and we all have kind of a responsibility that what we do is bringing everybody along with us. So a group like this, a little community like this, and you know, you're connected with other communities. We're all, you know, there's millions of us trying to bring along, and God knows we need it, don't we? I mean, the world needs this kind of help, so I appreciate what you're doing here, really. It makes a lot of difference.
Could you tell me the
3 A's
again?
Yeah. Awareness, and just paying attention. That's another A, this first A, attention or awareness. You know, mm-hmm. Noticing, just paying attention. You gotta pay attention. You gotta notice stuff. Acceptance. If you really pay attention, you'll accept things. It's already happening. So just pay attention and accept what is. But I don't like it. I know, I'm sorry. It's the way it is. The third is appreciating. If you really pay attention and accept it, wow, then you start to notice the magic of it and the beauty and the interconnectedness of it. You really get to appreciate your life. So, awareness, acceptance, appreciation.
So we could add that to our regular program. We can go to the 5 A's.
Yeah.
Now. Start a new thing.
I can't get past 3 myself.
Well, thanks to Larry.
Thank you.
A couple of closing closing thoughts. We also have Jim Blumenthal, who some people may know from Maitripa, who's coming, I think, the two middle Mondays in July. And he's going to teach from his new book on calm abiding meditation, which is based on a translation he's been working on for a couple of years with Geshe Sopa from Madison, Wisconsin, a monastery there. So he's going to come and talk about that for 2 consecutive Mondays in the middle. And then we also have some other retreats coming up at the end of July, July 30th, we have another event on the 19th of July to prepare for the retreat on the 30th, if anyone's interested in that. And then we also have another 10 or 12 day retreat on Sutra Tantra Dzogchen with a Tibetologist, Jim Valby from Massachusetts. We're going to have that at the Portland Yoga Center. So the thing that happens on the 19th, it's sort of preparation for those 2 other retreats. It's sort of an initiation, kind of a Tibetan type program. So if you're interested in those things, Tyson or I can give you information on that. Also, aren't we going to go to Sansai mm-hmm. tonight? We have fellowship and sushi. It's happy hour all day long. Mm-hmm. 21st is Hoyt. Everyone's welcome. Just tell Vicky if you're going so that she knows how many people to get a table for when we get there, because sometimes it's 8 or 10 or 15 people. It's going to be busy because it's summer, right? So if you want to go to sushi, and you should go because it's really fun and cheap and good. And then don't forget the Buddha bucket. Throw some ducats in the Buddha bucket. And, right? Yeah. We accumulated some positive merits in sitting here and accepting teachings and practicing meditation and getting out of self and trying to sangha and community and fellowship. So we just got to give it away to keep it. So we can, if you'd like to join me in this, just put your hands together and saying, you know, may this be of benefit. May all beings be free of suffering and the root of suffering.
May all beings be free of suffering and the root of suffering.
May all beings enjoy happiness and the causes of happiness.
May all beings enjoy happiness and